When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and Chuck is with me too. And we're just a couple of intrepid explorers sitting around in tiny rooms. I don't know what we're exploring, but we're exploring something.
Freezing to death?
Yeah, I'm a little warm, actually. I'm kind of sweaty.
Maybe scurvy? I don't know. Pneumonia?
Lead poisoning?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad things that happened about this expedition that we're going to talk about, the Franklin Expedition. Very, very famous, it wasn't a polar expedition, it was an Arctic expedition from the middle of the 19th century. And if you've ever seen that show on AMC, The Terror, did you ever watch that?
No, I remember you recommending that a while ago, though.
It's so good, Chuck. So there's two seasons, two totally different stories. I'm recommending the first one because it's all about like a speculative fiction about this.
About this very thing?
Yeah, believe it or not. No.
Just
the
one.
Second season is about a Japanese family in an internment camp during World War II.
Well, that sounds equally uplifting.
Totally different. But the first season is really amazing. And it is all about this. All the characters in that season are based on actual people from this expedition. It's really neat.
Well, now it all hits home.
Yeah, there you go. So even before AMC came along and did it, this is probably one of the most famous expeditions in history.
Sure.
Mainly because it was such a colossal catastrophe. There were 129 crew members, including the captain, the expedition leader, all the officers, and all the crew. And not one survived. All of the crew was lost. That's really rare, even for Arctic exploration back in the day.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, for a very long time, we had no real clue what happened to them. Well, we did. We just ignored the clues. But it was a mystery. They just vanished, basically. The last time they were seen was by a couple of whaling ships at the very beginning of their voyage,
mm-hmm.
and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of ways to disappear.
Especially in the Arctic.
Yeah, in the Arctic. In that time of, in the 19th century. Very easy to happen.
Yeah, but at the same time, this was remarkable even at the time. This was, it was weird that like these guys, this expedition just went so colossally bad. And then one of the reasons, like I was saying, that it's been such an enduring mystery is because we never really knew, we never had much evidence. And then we had scant evidence over time, and the little evidence that we did collect didn't really just explain everything. There were lots of question marks. And even today, with all the stuff we found and discovered along the way, we don't really know why this whole thing went so pear-shaped so quickly.
Yeah, for sure.
But we're going to talk about whatever we do know. I think that's our task today. Are you prepared for this task?
Sounds like a very not thought-out name that our show could have been called.
Our task is to explain this today?
No, everything we do know instead of stuff you should know.
Oh, okay.
Should we talk about the Northwest Passage?
I would love to because it's kind of important.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It kind of is and it kind of isn't. I think that they thought it was going to be really, really, really important back in the day when they were like, hey, listen, we got to find a route to sail basically straight from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, it didn't end up being a big, heavily used passage. There's a problem with the Northwest Passage, and that is it's really hard to get through.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Arctic islands up there north of Canada, and there's a lot of ice, and that ice moves around a lot. You can never exactly predict where you're going to find that ice mm-hmm. or where it's going to recede. And even when you're out there, it's going to be moving around. So it's almost like playing a game of Frogger sometimes when you're forget the car part, like the highway, like when you get to the river, because you're like, oh, you know, I got a passage now because I see it in front of me, but I might not have it in an hour because the ice moves. So it's a very tricky thing to get through. Mm-hmm. A lot of people and a lot of expeditions tried to get through it, charted, you know, great deals of it. And as we'll see in the end, John Franklin and his crew was tasked with basically about 300 miles of, you know, sort of figuring it out, charting it. And that was sort of the last bit. And even had it been all charted, it's still not like an easy thing to get through.
No. But just charting it was a huge mission for the Royal Navy, because at the time, the middle of the 19th century, the British Royal Navy was the greatest sea power in the world.
Sure.
And in their backyard, the Arctic, there was an entire piece of the globe that was just a blank question mark. I saw a really great documentary on Nova, and they showed a map of the world as they understood it in the mid-19th century, and everything else had been charted except for the spot in the middle of the Arctic.
And so they had it was a question mark there?
They actually did. They had a blank space and a question mark.
Amazing.
It was like the Riddler had done that cartography. But it was like a blemish on the reputation of the British Navy that they still hadn't been able to chart it, despite trying for hundreds of years to, at the very least, chart it, if not make it through. So it was a big deal, and that's they really wanted to do this.
Yeah, and like I said, a lot of people, you can't like point to a single person and say like they discovered this passage.
Right.
Kind of for some of the reasons we've been talking about, the 30,000 islands and the ice and people getting bits and pieces together a little bit at a time. But a lot of people take credit. There are a lot of people that are given credit for different parts of it. Mm-hmm. There was one guy named Robert McClure from the Royal Navy, of course. And he's credited as the first complete transit. Part of that was on land. And then there's a guy, a Norwegian named Roald Amundsen, who was like, all right, now this is the first guy who did it all by sea. And this was like, 50 plus years after McClure had done it partially on land. So mm-hmm. it's like a lot of time is passing. And this is at a time when the advances of sailing and getting through passages like this was sort of at its peak.
Yes. And by the way, Roald Amundsen, he was also the guy who was the first to make it to the South Pole. So he was quite a show off as far as explorers go.
Well, look at him.
So, yeah, it wasn't until the 20th century that somebody actually made it all the way through by ship. So it kind of goes to show you that, like, they weren't really successful, this Franklin expedition, and even after the expedition.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about it is Ed helped us out with this, and he made a point that there were a lot of rescue missions to go find the lost Franklin expedition. And while they were there, they charted stuff that had been uncharted.
Sure.
So Ed makes the point that by getting lost, Franklin actually contributed more to the charting of this unknown part of the Arctic than he did while he was actually alive, because he didn't actually make it very far, and his crew made it kind of far. But by the time they made it to where they were going, they couldn't have cared less about charting. They were just trying to stay alive, unsuccessfully, as we'll see.
Yeah, well, there you have it.
I guess I spoiled it. After having already said that not one of the 129 men survived.
Yeah, you're like, no, wait, I spoiled it in the first 30 seconds, not just now.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about Franklin, John Franklin, that is. Not Benjamin, of course.
Sure.
He hated boats. John Franklin was born in 1786, and he was not a rich guy. He did not come from some noble family, but he did end up getting a lot of seafaring experience in the Navy, a lot of combat experience. Like, he knew his way around a ship. So in 1819, he saw that the British Navy was downsizing some, mm-hmm. and the writing was kind of on the wall for, or at least he felt the writing was on the wall for him. And he said, all right, what I should do if I want to, you know, continue at sea and, you know, I kind of like this life is I got to get out of the military and become an explorer, become an Arctic explorer, because that was a, like a path post-military that you could do. You could become an adventurer.
Yeah. And he was still part of the British Royal Navy. He was a captain in it, but he wasn't engaging in warfare. He was engaging in exploration. So it was almost like they had two prongs. You could either go like Discovery Corps or, you know, the Corps of Death and Destruction.
Sounds like both lead to death.
Yeah, in this case, Discovery Corps didn't pan out very well.
I just spoil it again.
So, we'll just, everybody, just forget that everyone dies. We're working up to that, apparently.
So he got to work on his discovery path. He was doing pretty well. He commanded some expeditions here and there. One ended up being a big failure on the north coast of Canada, exploring near the Coppermine River. And half of the men died. The reason that this is noteworthy is because that even though it was a big failure, he gained a lot of notoriety because he survived grim conditions and very famously ate his boots to survive, ate the leather from his boots, which is a thing that happened on Alone on that TV show I watched, that some guy ate part of his belt.
Oh, yeah? How did it go down?
It didn't go down well.
I can't imagine it would, man.
I think the idea when you boil leather like that is that it's just, you know, some of the fat will come off and it might give you a little bit of caloric intake, but it's not a great plan for success long term.
Yeah.
But Franklin earned a lot of notoriety by eating his boots and wrote a big best-selling book about it and was knighted, even though it was a failure.
Yeah, because they kind of saw it as, you know, he had sacrificed that much in the name of exploration. So
sure,
why not knight him? You know, it's better than like throwing rotten tomatoes at him upon his return. The guy had to eat his boots for Pete's sake, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So that was one of his two initial expeditions. The one that we're talking about today was his third. The other one was pretty catastrophic, too. Nothing like the first one. And nothing like the third one, but still noteworthy enough that, like, it was not successful. They got lost. And both of those first expeditions, Franklin and his crew were bailed out by Inuit, who basically made sure that they stayed alive. He probably wouldn't have survived that first expedition had it not been help from the Inuit, who made sure that they made it back and were fed and all that stuff. And that's a big recurring theme that we're going to run into is the Inuit were in the background, like back in England, people knew they were there. They called them Eskimo,
right.
Spelled like it would if you were in New Orleans or something with the AUX at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what they did. They were not thought very highly of. And yet the whole time, as we'll see, like the Inuit were just witnesses to this history. Had an extensive and detailed oral history, knew exactly what happened, where everybody was, what went down, when. And yet the British and other European explorers just would not listen to them. And when they did listen to them and they tried to explain it to England, England shouted that person down and told them they were a fool for listening to the chattering of these Eskimo. So that's just kind of a common theme, as we'll see, that the Inuit played a huge outsized role that we're only now starting to kind of like acknowledge or recognize.
Yeah. They also, there was a common theme that if you were smart enough to listen to them while you were there, then you fared much better than if you did things your own way.
Definitely. But the problem was, is like, that was not something you would want to do back in the mid 19th century in front of your crew. You could very quickly like, your crew could lose confidence in you because you were doing something totally out of the norm and probably out of the bounds of respectable behavior by following the lead of you know, an Inuit at the time. Or I'm sorry, an Inuk. Something I learned is Inuit is the plural, Inuk is the singular. So if you're talking to, you wouldn't say I'm talking to an Americans. You'd say I'm talking to an American. And in the same way, you'd say I'm talking to an Inuk who's a member of the Inuit.
Yeah, what they were smart to do would be to take an Inuk around behind a big block of ice and very quietly say, listen, old boy, if you have any advice, please just let me know quietly. Happy to follow.
Can you draw out where we should go in the snow?
Right. And then, yes, yeah. And then erase it very quickly. And
with pee.
Save face. Yeah, with your urine. or wait. Erase it with urine or spell it out in urine?
You would erase it with urine. You could do both, but the spelling it out with urine would be too permanent. You would want to pee all over it, and it would melt out the instructions once you committed them to memory, and everybody in your crew would have thought you just went behind the ice block to pee.
Well, that's why they have the slogan as the Sharpie of snow riding.
What does pee?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's permanent. I didn't know that. I didn't know pee had its own slogan.
It did. I really circumnavigated that like a big ice flow.
That was nice.
Clumsily, somewhat breaking through with my iron force.
There were a couple of bumps in there, sure.
All right. So where are we? He had the second expedition that you said wasn't as bad as the first and third. Still not great.
Right.
He's kind of thinking about hanging up his half-eaten boiled boots at this point. Mm-hmm. He's in his 50s. And in 1837, they said, no, why don't you take this appointment as the lieutenant governor of Van Diemen's Land, which we now know as Tasmania.
Sure.
And that only lasted a few years. And his wife, Jane, said, you know, what you should really do is finish strong. You're getting old. You got one more in you just to sort of save the family name. Mm-hmm. One more Arctic expedition that might really be great and cement you as a victor. And he said, I guess I'll try if they'll have me.
He said, Roger, Roger.
Yeah.
So he did. She did, I should say. He kind of just went along with it. But Lady Jane Franklin really worked behind the scenes to get her husband appointed to the head of an Arctic expedition. And in particular, this one that was considered potentially the last one to map the Northwest Passage, because there was only that 300 miles of uncharted territory.
So I got a question, though. Was this a situation where they gave it to this older guy because no one wanted to do it because it was so dangerous? Or, like, I saw that, you know, younger captains, you know, declined to take the position. Mm-hmm. Is it because it was just so fraught?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's possible, but that seems like that would fly in the face of, like, the Royal Navy and their attitude at the time. Like, you would step up and be like, yes, I'll be the one to die, rather than be like, oh, I don't want that, you know? So I'm not sure exactly why. I'll have to go back and watch The Terror again.
How historically accurate is it?
Extremely, but at the same time, it also veers off into, like, just wild speculation.
Okay. I got to see it now.
Yeah, I can't really get across how good it is. And it's one of those ones where, you know, when somebody talks something up and you go in expecting high hopes with high hopes, and you're invariably let down, you will not be let down.
All right.
That's how great it is. I expect texts from you every, like, couple hours while you're watching it.
Should we take a break?
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. We've got it set up in that he is going to take this final voyage to restore his name, and we'll be back right after this to let you know what happened.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible.
That's right. It's even in the name. Use code STUFF20 at checkout to receive $20 off your first month. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month every month, taxes and fees included.
Yep. Again, use promo code STUFF20 and you'll receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Save on wireless with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. Switch now at visible.com.
For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, so Lady Jane Franklin has successfully secured the appointment of as head of this expedition in 1846, I believe, an 1846 expedition to the Arctic, to uncharted territory, largely because no one else would accept it, but also because she maneuvered. I think without her wrangling, he still might not have gotten it, even though no one else wanted it. He was ready to go out to pasture, and the Royal Navy was more than willing to let him go. Lady Jane Franklin said, no, meet my sheer will. And they did. And so he became head. And it's not like he was just some hapless boob or something
Of course not.
He wasn't the finest captain in the Royal Navy. I'm sure he wasn't the worst either. He was just, you know, average. And his track record wasn't so great. And there were plenty of other captains in the Royal Navy that had far better track records than him. But I don't want to get across like he was the wrong man for the job. He just wasn't necessarily the best man for the job.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to make up a funny name for the worst captain in the Royal Navy, but I kind of stopped.
I got nothing either.
Yeah.
No matter how I try, I guarantee it won't be good.
Like, what's something funny about someone who can't sail?
They have lead feet.
How about Leadfoot Mick can't swim?
Oh, boy.
He's the worst.
That's not a good sailor right there. Or James Francis can't steer.
Right. I love it. Speaking of steering, should we talk about these boats?
Yeah, let's, because they're kind of important, too.
Yeah, very important. One, as I guess is named for the TV show, The Terror.
Or vice versa.
Yeah, and the Erebus, what I said it was named after the TV show. And the Erebus, these were, previous to this outing, they were warships, but they were ships that didn't, you know, have like cannons up and down the sides. They were delivering big mortar rounds close to shore. Mm-hmm. So they were squatty and they were super strong, and they were sailing ships, but they were retrofitted for this adventure. I keep calling it an adventure.
It was an adventure. I think that's fair. Yeah.
For a while, at least. They were retrofitted in a bunch of ways. First of all, adding these iron plates to the front to, you know, break through the ice. Mm-hmm. But then they also added a steam engine to the sailing vessel, not to just use full time, but, you know, because you require too much coal. You can't do something like that. Mm-hmm. But to get you through, like I was talking about that moving ice, if they were like, oh my gosh, we need to get over there quick because I see a channel that's closing, they could kick in that steam and get over there faster. That's just like one ways that they would use the steam engine.
Yeah, like if you were playing Frogger, you wanted your steam engines going.
Exactly.
So they also figured out how to use the steam as basically central heating. This was
pretty cool.
State of the art. We're talking like the late 1840s here. And these guys were going on an Arctic expedition, and I think they may have been the first crew ever to sail into the Arctic with central heat. So that was an enormous luxury. And they also used the steam system as a water distillation system. So they had all the fresh water they needed, but they could desalinate it, they could decontaminate it. It was just a really ingenious system all kind of built into one.
Yeah. And if you're wondering about the propellers being a problem with the ice, they actually retracted back into the hull when they were in shallow water and icy water. So like for the 1840s, this felt like a very modern operation.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So it's important to remember, though, that the steam was meant to just kind of give them a boost. They were still sailing ships. That's mostly how they moved, was through sail.
Yeah. And they brought a lot of stuff. We always like to talk about the load of any expedition and what they kind of carried, because it's usually a precursor to they didn't either have enough or they had the wrong stuff. They had 32,000 pounds of beef, 33,000 pounds of tinned meat, which will very much come into play. We'll get to that later. They had fresh veggies. They had livestock. They had live animals on board, right?
They had cattle, sheep, pigs, hens.
Sure.
All meant to probably not last very long. And then
so eating was good at first.
Exactly. They also had pets, too, Chuck. There were three pets. There was a monkey that Lady Jane Franklin gave to the ship as a present, and I guess was kind of Captain Franklin's pet.
Yeah.
And apparently used to steal stuff a lot, but it was a super cute monkey, so everybody forgave him every time.
Yeah.
Much more popular was a dog named Neptune in Newfoundland. Yeah. I mean, come on.
Gotta have a dog on board.
And then there was a cat that may or may not have had a name, because I think I got this information from a historian named John Geiger, who has basically dedicated his career to the Franklin expedition. And he does not name this cat. And the fact that he didn't makes me think that cat didn't have a name. It was just the cat.
I don't think they named cats for a while.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've seen a lot of historical stories where there was like a cat they just called cat.
So, like, Mr. Sphinx didn't come around until, like, the 70s, maybe?
I don't know.
We'll find out. Less of short stuff just waiting to happen, I
totally.
Guess.
Totally. They also had thousands of pounds of sugar, had tons of spices. I mentioned the veggies. They had, you got to have tobacco. They had about 7,000-plus pounds of tobacco. Tons of booze, 4,000 gallons of either rum or wine. close to 3,000 pounds of candles so they could see, because, you know, it gets during the winter there, it's dark for long, long periods of time.
For sure.
Lemon juice, lots of lemon juice.
That's a big one. They had 930 gallons of lemon juice to stave off scurvy, and every crew member got an ounce a day. And unfortunately, it didn't work for a lot of people. A lot of guys seem to have gotten scurvy. Their teeth fell out and they were fatigued and all sorts of terrible things happened because of a vitamin C deficiency, and yet they had enough lemon. And apparently historians think that the lemon juice may have started to ferment. And so to kill off that bacteria, they may have boiled the lemon juice to get kind of recharge it. And in doing so, that would render the ascorbic acid, the vitamin C, totally ineffective, inert, basically. And so they could have been drinking lemon juice all day long and they still would have gotten scurvy. So that's a great theory. I don't know how accurate it is, but it's the best one I've heard. It's also the only one I've heard, but it still seemed pretty good.
And how about we set up the first part of this tinned food thing, and then we'll reveal what happened later.
Yeah.
It was sort of a new thing. Usually you would take dry goods, like salted pork and stuff like that, if you wanted to eat well on a ship. But Franklin said, no, let's do this a little better. Tinning technology is new. I'm going to contract with this guy. His name's Stephen Goldner. And I was about to say the best at this, but he was doing this. And they said, give us whatever you can get us on time. We need 8,000 tins of food, cooked beef, cooked pork, preserved meat, all soup even.
Don't forget the pemmican.
Oh, well, what is pemmican? I've heard of that. It's
I saw it described as paste of dried and pounded meat mixed with fat and spices. I saw it compared to oily beef jerky. And then some people, like, I guess keto people, like, will add, like, maybe some fruit or something to it just for a little bit of carbs.
Okay.
But it was a very popular staple in the Arctic because it was fatty and full of protein. And that's what you needed.
Those are good things.
Yeah, for sure.
And Goldner was like, all right, this stuff is going to be great. It'll last you a few years. And I need to get to work, though, because I have a short timeline. But delivered those tins, and that's where we're going to leave it for now.
Yeah. So they took on all these supplies. I think after they passed Scotland in Disco Bay, D-I-S-K-O.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah. So close.
They do not dance in Disco Bay.
No.
That's in Greenland, on the west coast of Greenland. That's where they took on supplies. And then also, really interestingly, they left behind five guys. There were originally 134 crew members.
Mm-hmm.
But five of them were left behind in Greenland because they were basically booted off the ship by Franklin. The only explanation I saw is that they had run afoul of his bans on swearing and drunkenness. Mm-hmm. So they actually managed to avoid this grim fate
by
cursing and being drunk, essentially.
Yeah.
So,
good for them.
Yeah, for sure. So they took on all of these supplies. They took on the coal. They took on all the tinned meat and all that. And they started sailing toward Baffin Bay, not the one in Texas. This one is up in the Arctic. And they were about to enter Lancaster Sound, or they did. Right before they did, they were sighted by a couple of whaling ships, the Enterprise and the Prince of Wales. And it's really disappointing they didn't spell the Prince of Wales like a whale. They spelled it like the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whaling ship. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, boat names are supposed to be puns.
For sure. For sure. Like a... I can't think of one right now.
I can't either.
All of them are, though, aren't they?
Yeah.
At least the ones in Florida and, you know, California, like San Diego.
Yeah, they're very punny usually.
Okay, so these whaling ships hung out with them. Apparently, they boarded and, like, looked around. They were like, oh, my God, central heat. When they took their leave of the Erebus and the Terror, they were the last Europeans to see these people alive.
That's right.
And one of the other things I just want to say about Lancaster Sound, Chuck, from Baffin Bay, if you look at it on a map and they don't map out the sea ice, you could shoot an arrow from Baffin Bay to the Arctic Ocean, which would eventually take you to the Pacific, just straight through Lancaster Sound. And yet, because of the ice, it was so bad, they couldn't go anywhere near across Lancaster Sound. They had to immediately start to go south.
Yeah, boy, go south indeed.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we should talk a little bit about sort of how you navigate through this ice. We did mention that had, you know, iron on the front of their ships, and any sort of ice ship or fishing ship that's in icy waters will have a reinforced hull because, you know, you can break through some of this stuff. If you ever watch, you know, Deadliest Catch, they do that kind of thing here and there. But if you really get sort of in a position where you know, the ice is too thick, and, you know, this ice is continually being just smashed against the shore until you have, like, ice mountains along the shoreline.
Mm-hmm.
And it just stacks up on each other. So eventually, if you get to a place where you really can't get through, there are a couple of things you can do. You can wait for summer and, like, cross your fingers that it'll melt, because it may not even melt then.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can use a process called warping, which is when you basically inch yourself along little by little by... if there's land nearby, you could, like, tie yourself to something strong on land and winch yourself by little by little. If there's no land around, you can put your anchor in a dinghy and send somebody out. Probably not a dinghy, a little bit bigger boat. Drop the anchor and then winch yourself toward that anchor. But it is extremely slow going if you can even get through at that point. I think Ed used one example of a rescue expedition that was trying to find Franklin that spent 9 hours basically going the length of their ship, mm-hmm. like an inch at a time. So it's not fun. It is, but it's like that may be your only chance at survival sometimes, because you could get stuck in ice forever and die.
For sure. And that's actually what the Franklin expedition found themselves in, that situation.
Yeah.
At first, they were doing fine. They wintered at Beachy Island,
mm-hmm.
Which is not very far past where they entered from Baffin Bay, because I think they set sail on May 19th.
Mm-hmm. And winter comes quickly.
Right, exactly. They finally left Disco Bay in July of 1845. So, yeah, winter comes way earlier up there than it does here. Mm-hmm. So they wintered pretty quickly. And they were successful that first winter. The ice started to melt, and they started to do some cool little navigating and apparently doing U-turns and all sorts of stuff that we'll never probably know exactly what they did.
Yeah.
But that first winter and summer went fine.
Yeah, but three guys did die of basically kind of how you die back then in those conditions. Could have been pneumonia. Mm-hmm. It could have been, I mean, who knows what kind of health some of these guys were in, but it wasn't anything like super unusual. They just lost three guys.
Yes, but that supposedly was not a good record, even for an Arctic expedition, losing three guys that quickly.
Yeah.
So aside from the three deaths, fine. Things went pretty well. Compared to the rest of the expedition, that was great, right?
Well, sure.
So the first winter comes and goes, the first summer comes and goes, and now they've made it to the northwest corner of King William Island, and they get iced in for the winter. And again, this is what they're expecting. They had 3 years' worth of supplies. They figured mm-hmm. it would take that long to circumnavigate all of this, you know, this ice flow and throughout these seasons. So they're not worried yet. When they start to worry is when the next summer comes and the ice doesn't melt.
Right. And that's what I mentioned earlier by crossing your fingers. You know, it sometimes it melts, sometimes it doesn't. It all depends on the conditions at the time. Mm-hmm. At this point, they had been there for a while. And like you said, we're surviving. And they were even sending guys ashore that were, you know, charting their location. And nothing was really out of the ordinary. Like you said, until they were like, well, we're still stuck. Mm-hmm. And that's when it got fairly scary. This is, I guess, spring or what would be spring. I don't even know what you would call May in that area in 1847. Winter part two, maybe?
Sure.
There was a team that went to leave. They had this method for leaving messages. They would use these Royal Navy forms, basically like they should have just had letterhead because they would have had more room to write. But instead, they would write in the margins of these Royal Navy forms just to make sure people knew it was them. And they would leave them in sealed canisters in various places. This one was under a cairn that someone else had built before them. And it was a pretty brief note. Things were okay.
Yeah.
Nothing out of the ordinary to report at that time. These people came back to the ship from, you know, delivering this note and making sure it was safe to be found later. And Franklin had died while they were gone on June 11th.
Yeah, they even said in the note, Franklin commanding.
Yeah.
And then
they should have said, as far as we know.
Right. So that's, that's kind of a big deal. I mean, the leader of the expedition dies.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like, what do we do now? I mean, there was a second in command, a guy named Francis Crozier, and then a third in command named James Fitzjames. So there was like a clear chain of command of able captains and leaders, right?
Sure.
But it's still, I mean, at the very least, that just seems like bad juju when you're up on an Arctic expedition and you've been snowed in through a summer, right?
Yeah, and a few other people died too. So at this point, they've lost, you know, probably close to 10 people.
So from September 1846, when they first got iced in for the second time, this time off the northwest coast of King William Island, all the way through 1848, and actually beyond, they just sat there. Their ships were iced in. They didn't move. They just stayed there. If the ice moved, then the ships moved, but that was it. They didn't move within the ice. And these guys are like living on these ships, kind of living on shore. They made camps. And then they finally abandoned the ships because it was becoming clear that, I guess, Crozier had this gamble to make. He could either wait to see if the ice melted next summer, and in which case they could probably make it through to safety. They could sail to safety during the summer and be saved. But if the ice didn't melt, he would have wasted several months waiting to see if the ice melted when they could have been walking to safety. And he chose option B. He said, we need to start moving toward safety because I don't think that this ice is going to melt again.
Yeah. And the Inuit, the ones who listened to them, a few dozen of them did make it to mainland Canada. But just because you made it to mainland Canada doesn't mean like that you're saved. Like they were still in big trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously. At this point, Lady Jane, well, should we take a break now, actually?
Yeah,
let's take a break.
Should. Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break and talk about what Lady Jane did right after this.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible.
That's right. It's even in the name. Use code STUFF20 at checkout to receive $20 off your first month. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month every month, taxes and fees included.
Yep. Again, use promo code STUFF20 and you'll receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Save on wireless with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. Switch now at Visible.com.
For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right. So at this point, things are going really bad. The expedition itself, as far as trying to get these last 300 miles of that passage figured out, was, I mean, forget about that at this point. These guys are just trying to be alive.
They're walking across frozen sea ice that they're just walking. It's that much ice that it's just like one continuous sheet all the way to Canada.
Yeah. Not a healthy prospect for survival.
No, and one other thing, Chuck, I want to throw in. They're not just walking. They're pushing huge ships loaded with supplies. They're dragging them and pushing them along this ice and rock. Okay?
Not a fun task.
No, exactly.
So this is where the search period begins, which spanned from 1847 to 1859. All kinds of people went out looking. Lady Jane was ringing that bell. The Royal Navy was offering up £20,000 in 1850, ton of money.
Do you want to know?
I mean, let's hear it. Is this an American or pounds?
I got both, buddy.
Well, let's hear it.
That would be 2.2 million pounds today or $2.8 million today.
What about euros?
Oh, I didn't do that one. You got me.
Yeah, interesting.
You could have said, what about drachmas?
You're typically more thorough, but that's fine.
Sorry.
No, that's a lot of money. Enough to attract what eventually ended up being over 30 expeditions that were going to be fraught with the same peril, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like things had changed and it was now easy, but it was, you know, it's sort of like in Jaws, you know, all these people had money on their mind. They had their mind on their money and the money on their minds.
That's right.
And wanted all those pounds. And it was a big public thing. Like, people wanted them back and they tried to get them back their hardest.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the reasons why John Franklin was known was because he was the man who ate his boot.
Gotta get that guy.
The English pub, right. And the English public was also very much fascinated with Arctic exploration. It would be kind of analogous to the American public being interested in going to the moon in the 60s.
Yeah.
Kind of like that.
Yeah. Not like now. No one cares.
No, sadly. Hopefully everybody will get reinterested again when we start going to the moon again soon.
One of the big names in the one of these search parties was a guy named John Ray. He was a guy that sort of, we'll get to kind of his big reveal in a second here, but he was very noteworthy and proficient guy. Mm-hmm. He knew what he was doing. He had been all over the Arctic. I think he was one of the guys who listened to the Inuit, right?
He was, and he got shouted down as a result because he came back from this exploration and interviewing a number of Inuit, and he said, hey, they told me that these guys definitely engaged in cannibalism. That's how desperate they became. And that did not—
They didn't want to hear that.
No, that did not sit well with Lady Jane Franklin. And she actually got Charles Dickens to basically write this diatribe about how terrible a person Ray was for listening to the Inuit and how terrible—
Charles Dickens.
Yeah, how terrible the Inuit were. John Geiger says that it was just a stain on his reputation that continues today. It was very racist, the stuff that he wrote, and he did it on behalf of Lady Jane Franklin to basically say, like, you're slandering these heroes. And Dickens even said, if they're dead, I'll bet it was the Inuit that did this.
Yeah.
Anything but the possibility that they actually became so desperate to engage in cannibalism. And as we'll see, it turns out the Inuit who said that this happened were actually proven correct like a century later.
Yeah, exactly. By the 1900s, they had found graves. They had found corpses. They had found a lot of the stuff except for the ships. And remarkably, not even 10 years ago, in 2014 mm-hmm. and in 2016, they found the Erebus and the Terror, respectively, in about 30 feet of water, fairly intact, considering how long it had been. And this was, I think Terror was off of King William Island. Erebus was a little further south near the Adelaide Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And they don't know for sure if how the Erebus exactly got there, whether it was sailed there or moved there or just accidentally drifted there, some combination of all those. Who knows?
Yeah, it's possible it drifted like after the ice melted. Some people say maybe the ice moved it all the way down there. That wouldn't have happened. It would have crushed the boat. It could have very easily been sailed. But either way, like finding those ships was enormous. And there's really cool Parks Canada videos of scuba divers swimming through these ships that are like almost entirely intact.
Mm-hmm.
There's like still dishes on the shelves and bottles on shelves and like desks intact. And the drawers are closed. They think because of the state of the water and the anaerobic conditions that there's probably lots of documentation of what went on during the expedition in those drawers that they're going to eventually be able to get to.
Totally. As far as why they perished, there are a bunch of theories, sort of, you know, three of them can be kind of lumped together and it could happen to sort of any expedition, which is, you know, bad luck with the weather, you know, those two really bad winters in a row without that summer thaw that they maybe were counting on. Combined with not being as prepared as you should have been, I guess two, not three. Even though they were prepared, they were heavily stocked. This was just really rough territory, and the clothes they had might not have been perfect. They really held water well, which would freeze. The equipment was really heavy. They, like we said, they weren't listening to the locals about how you should really do things.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing things their way, so that's a kind of underpreparedness. And so those are just sort of under the normal ways that one could die on an expedition like this then.
And with the bad luck in particular, where they got iced in for that second winter, even the Inuit are like, we don't really go around there. They called it Tununi, which is back of beyond, which is a terrible name for a place that you're iced in the Arctic.
Uh-huh.
And then on that NOVA documentary, they took ice core samples and they found that those winters that they were iced in were two of the worst winters in 700 years in that area.
That's called so bad luck.
They had terribly bad luck for sure.
Yeah. / underprepared because they shouldn't have been there to begin with.
Right.
So those are all sort of normal ways that you could perish. Like I said, the last one that we have to talk about, though, is this lead poisoning. We talked about the contract with the guy that was innovating with his 10 meats. He had to rush this thing through. It apparently leaked lead, and you know, it was lined with lead, and that leaked into the food. They did lots of studies over the years. The first, I believe, was 1981. There was an anthropologist named Dr. Owen Beatty, and basically was the first person to say, you know, I think this, we've literally are finding lead in their bones, like at levels that we should not see. And it seems pretty obvious there was lead in the examined corpses. Mm-hmm. Like, it may not have been everything, but it definitely had something to do with a lot of the deaths.
Yeah, it's kind of criticized that he didn't have a control group. Like, it's possible these guys had tons of lead in their bodies anyway, just from lifelong exposure to lead. And that it's possible their bones released it as they started to die, basically.
Right.
We don't know because there isn't a control group, but it's quite possible that it had some effect on the expedition if it wasn't directly killing people. They also think that the contaminated tins or that the poorly soldered tins may have been contaminated with botulism, which would have killed off a lot of people too.
Yeah.
And then, it's just not clear. A lot, like those first three graves that they found from the first winter, like you said, they died from pneumonia, from tuberculosis. But so few people have been found, and the state that they've been found in hasn't really allowed for forensic anthropology to say, this is how this guy died, this is how this guy died. So it's all left to the imagination.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that captures my imagination the most is that there are Inuit reports that in the summer of either 1851 or 1852, there were still four survivors left from this crew, four of them and a dog, probably Neptune the Newfoundland, I imagine, mm-hmm. and that they were the most skilled at hunting, so they had survived the longest, and they were all that was left. And by 1851, 1852, there had already been numerous search expeditions launched.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that there were people searching for them while there were still survivors. They just didn't, their paths didn't cross. They just didn't find one another. And those last four were the last of them. And
yeah.
I guess they did not go on.
Yeah. I guess we should talk a little bit about the cannibalism thing because that's, you know, that was what Ray was sort of brave enough to talk about and was, you know, like you said, he was basically shunned because of this. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to hear anything like that. And it turns out that he was right. I mean, there's no other way to say it. They found cut marks on bones, on leg bones. They found a skull from the same person that was intentionally broken. All these, like, they now that we know what cannibal sites look like, mm-hmm. it has all the markings, basically.
Literally.
Yeah, like intentionally breaking bones, cutting bones on purpose. What else? They found like clusters of bones together.
Like they'd just been tossed.
That weren't like just part of the body dying, like bones that shouldn't be together were together.
Yeah. And then a lot of the bones that were found were like long bones. So they suspect that they had just been like carrying arms and legs as portable food. It was a bad jam. So it is clear that they did engage in cannibalism. And not only was Ray right, the Inuit who told Ray that they had engaged in cannibalism were right. And throughout some of these expeditions that came during this, what's called the Franklin search period from 1857 to 59, a lot of Inuit agreed to be interviewed with translators with some of these explorers, and they documented these interviews. And it wasn't until like a century later that historians like John Geiger went through this stuff and was like, oh, the Inuit knew all along exactly what had happened. Well, apparently, one of them pointed to where the ship was, the Erebus, and they still didn't discover it for another century after that. So it's a really interesting just kind of side note that like there's this whole group of people who are willing to cooperate and share their knowledge, and they were just totally ignored. And that's what led to the mystery that lasted for over a century.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it hadn't have been for him poking around more, they were quite happy just to leave this as it was, and that sort of be the end of it all.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
Good stuff.
Yeah, so that's the Franklin expedition. And now that we found the ships, yeah, they are pretty confident that we'll have a lot more information soon. So that'll be pretty cool to look out for. And since I said it's cool to look out for, oh, by the way, if you want to know more about this, go check out that Nova episode on it. It's really, really good. And since I said that, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this the shortest short stuff, because this is from Kent. And Kent talks, he's basically sending in a short stuff suggestion, but I think says enough about the thing that it can just be its own little episode here at the end.
Oh, neat.
We were talking about the 70s trucker craze on the trucker episode, Long Haul Trucking. And he said, we all know truckers have their own lingo, but one phrase that has died out in usage is the Monfort lane. You ever heard of this?
I hadn't until I wrote his email.
Yeah, the Monfort lane referred to the left lane of the interstate. In the early 70s, a Colorado cattle legend named Kenny Monfort started shipping meat to the East Coast. He had a fleet of supposedly triple-digit trucks and drivers who were not afraid to mash it. They turned two trips a week from Colorado to New York City. One driver recalled he had $1,200 in speeding fines one year when these were back when tickets were about 15 bucks and points didn't accumulate on your license.
That's important.
Yeah, you just rack them up forever and have the company pay for them, I guess. And interestingly, the Monfort family is now the principal owners of the Colorado Rockies baseball team.
That is very interesting.
And that is from Kent.
Thanks a lot, Kent. Good stuff all around. That was a short stuff right there on the end of the Franklin Expedition episode.
Great.
If you want to be like, what was it, Kent?
Kent.
If you want to be like Kent and give us a little short stuff that we can add on as a listener mail, I think that's a cool new thing. Let's give it a shot. And you can send that to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/powersafely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.